A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good one. He's asking about energy management, not the corporate buzzword kind, but the actual daily struggle of having an unpredictable tank of fuel. Some people wake up, and their energy is just. But for folks with ADHD, chronic fatigue, long COVID, digestive conditions, or a bunch of other things, it's more like a slot machine. You never quite know what you're getting, or when it's going to run out. And the question is, how do occupational therapists actually work with patients to build systems around that unpredictability? And for the rest of us who can't access an OT, what can we steal from their playbook?
I love this question because it gets at what occupational therapy actually is versus what most people think it is. Most people hear occupational therapy and think it's about helping someone get a job or maybe handwriting exercises for kids. And it's so much stranger and more interesting than that.
It's the glockenspiel of medical specialties.
I'm not entirely sure what that means, but I'm going to accept it. The core idea in OT is something called occupational performance. And occupation here doesn't mean employment, it means any meaningful activity that occupies your time. Brushing your teeth, making dinner, parenting, working, leisure, all of it. And the therapist's job is to figure out what's getting in the way of this person doing the things they need and want to do, and how do we design around it.
They're less medical detective and more systems architect.
Or maybe both. And when it comes to energy management, there's this whole framework they use that I don't think gets enough attention. It's called the Energy Conservation Framework, and it's been a core part of OT practice for decades. Originally developed for people with multiple sclerosis and post-polio syndrome, actually, the basic insight was that these patients didn't just need to push through fatigue. They needed to completely rethink how they allocated their energy across a day, a week, sometimes a month.
Push through, being the advice that actually makes everything worse.
And that's where one of the most important concepts comes in, pacing. The CDC actually has formal guidance on pacing for ME/CFS, which is myalgic encephalomyelitis / chronic fatigue syndrome, and their framework is very specific. They talk about patients needing to identify their personal energy envelope, the amount of activity they can do without triggering what's called post-exertional malaise, or PEM.
Post-exertional malaise. That's the crash.
That's the crash. And here's the thing that most people don't understand about PEM. It's not just feeling tired after doing something hard, it's a disproportionate, often delayed collapse. Someone might do a load of laundry, feel fine in the moment, and then be completely bedbound for 2 days. The CDC emphasizes that pacing isn't about avoiding activity. It's about staying within a sustainable range so you don't trigger that cycle.
The first thing an OT does is help someone figure out where their ceiling actually is. Not where they wish it was, not where it used to be, but where it actually is right now.
That's harder than it sounds, because most people, and I include myself in this, have a terrible sense of their own energy expenditure. We tend to think in terms of big, obvious drains, but miss the cumulative effect of small things. An OT will often have a patient keep what's called an activity log, sometimes for a couple of weeks. It's not just a schedule, it's a record of what they did, for how long, and how they felt afterward, often using a simple numeric scale.
Like a food diary, but for effort.
And what emerges from those logs is often surprising. Someone might discover that a 20-minute phone call with a particular person leaves them more drained than an hour of focused work. Or that showering in the morning consumes a huge chunk of their available energy for the day, and maybe they should shower at night instead. Or that they have a reliable window between 10 and noon where they're consistently functional, and everything outside that is a gamble.
That last one is huge. The idea that you might have a consistent daily window. I've heard ADHD coaches talk about something similar, finding your peak hours and protecting them ruthlessly.
Yes, and this is where the ADHD piece connects in a really interesting way. With chronic fatigue, the issue is primarily about physical energy depletion and PEM. With ADHD, the energy is often there, but the ability to direct it, to initiate tasks, and to avoid context switching costs is what's compromised. It's less about a limited fuel tank and more about a faulty steering system.
The same OT intervention, activity logging and scheduling, serves a completely different purpose depending on the population.
For the ME/CFS patient, you're trying to avoid crashes. For the ADHD patient, you're trying to reduce what researchers call task friction, all the tiny barriers between intention and action that eat up executive function. An executive function for someone with ADHD is a genuinely limited resource. It depletes over the course of a day. So an OT might help someone with ADHD batch similar tasks together to reduce context switching costs or build what's called a body double arrangement. Having someone else present, even virtually, while they work on a task.
Body doubling is fascinating. It's like outsourcing the initiation circuit to someone else's presence.
There's actually decent research on this now. The presence of another person, even if they're not helping, even if they're just on a video call doing their own work, seems to provide just enough external structure to bypass some of that executive function deficit. It's not fully understood, but the leading theory is that it lightly activates the social brain in a way that helps with self-regulation.
We've got pacing and energy envelopes for the physical fatigue crowd, and task batching and body doubling for the ADHD crowd. What about this third group the prompt mentions? People with digestive conditions where meals can knock them out for hours.
This is an area where OT gets really creative, because you're dealing with a predictable but unavoidable energy drain. If you know that eating lunch is going to cause bloating, discomfort, and brain fog for 2 to 3 hours afterward, you can't just, but you can completely restructure your day around that reality.
Like scheduling meetings before lunch and deep work after, or the reverse.
It depends on the person and the nature of their symptoms, but a common OT approach is what's called activity timing analysis. You map out the fixed energy drains, things like meals, medication schedules, child pickup times, and then you slot the flexible activities into the remaining windows based on their cognitive or physical demands. For someone with postprandial brain fog, you might schedule administrative tasks, email, or light household stuff for the post-meal window, and protect the pre-meal clear-headed hours for anything requiring real concentration.
You're not fighting the biology. You're choreographing around it.
That's the whole philosophy. OT is fundamentally about adapting the environment and the activity to fit the person, rather than trying to force the person to fit the activity. And I think that's the part that's most transferable for people who can't access a therapist. The mindset shift is, stop asking, why can't I do this normally? And start asking, how do I redesign this so it works with my actual body and brain?
That's a hard shift, though. There's a lot of grief and self-judgment wrapped up in not being able to do things the normal way.
And a good OT addresses that, too. There's a whole psychosocial component to this work. But on the practical level, once someone accepts that their energy patterns are what they are, the design space opens up enormously. Let me give you a concrete example from the literature. There's a technique called the 4 P's prioritization, planning, pacing, and positioning. It's been used in OT for decades.
Walk me through them.
Prioritization is deciding what actually matters. Not everything on your to-do list is equally important, and when energy is limited, you have to be ruthless. An OT might help someone categorize tasks into must do, should do, and nice to do, and then give explicit permission to let the nice to do items go when energy is low.
Permission is underrated. Sometimes you need a professional to tell you it's okay to not fold the laundry.
It sounds trivial, but it's therapeutic. Planning is the next piece, and this is where it gets tactical. It's not just making a list, it's spreading demanding tasks across the week so you're not stacking too many high-energy activities on a single day. It's also about identifying which tasks can be broken into smaller chunks. If vacuuming the whole house wipes you out, can you do one room today and another tomorrow?
The chunking thing seems obvious in retrospect, but I think most people's default is to see a task as an indivisible unit. You either clean the kitchen or you don't.
That all-or-nothing thinking is one of the biggest barriers to energy management, especially with ADHD. There's actually a concept in OT called grading. You modify the difficulty or duration of an activity so the person can succeed at it. Maybe they can't cook a full meal, but they can chop vegetables for 15 minutes and then rest. Maybe they can't write a report in one sitting, but they can write for 25 minutes using a timer, take a break, and come back.
That's basically the Pomodoro technique, but prescribed clinically.
And the third P is pacing. We've touched on this, but in the 4Ps framework, it specifically means alternating activity with rest and learning to recognize the early warning signs of overexertion before you hit the crash point.
What are those warning signs? I feel like most people don't notice them until it's too late.
They vary by condition, but common ones include increased heart rate, brain fog, irritability, physical heaviness, or a sudden drop in concentration. The OT helps the patient develop what's called interoceptive awareness, the ability to sense internal body states. A lot of people with chronic conditions have actually lost touch with those signals because they've spent years pushing through them.
You have to relearn how to listen to your own body, which is wild, because you'd think that would be the one thing you wouldn't need to learn.
It's surprisingly common. And then the fourth P is positioning. This is about ergonomics and body mechanics. How you sit, how you stand, whether your workstation is set up to minimize physical strain. For someone with chronic pain or fatigue, something as simple as sitting instead of standing while chopping vegetables can make a meaningful difference in energy expenditure.
A stool in the kitchen. That's the clinical intervention.
Sometimes it really is that simple. But the skill of the OT is in identifying which simple change will have the biggest impact for this specific person. It's not about applying generic advice. It's about matching the intervention to the individual's actual life, actual home, actual constraints.
Let's talk about the home context specifically, because the prompt mentions people working from home with childcare and house care duties. That's a very specific kind of chaos.
It is, and it's a context where energy management becomes exponentially harder because the boundaries between different roles, worker, parent, homemaker, are completely blurred. There's no commute to create a transition. There's no physical separation. An OT working with someone in this situation will often focus heavily on what's called environmental modification.
Which means what, in practice?
It could mean creating visual cues that signal, I'm in work mode now. Even if you're at the kitchen table. It could mean establishing a family routine where certain hours are protected for focused work and everyone in the household understands that. It could mean reorganizing the physical space so that frequently used items are within easy reach, reducing the number of trips up and down stairs, which, for someone with fatigue, is a real energy cost.
The stair thing. I hadn't even thought about that as an energy drain, but of course it is.
OTs think about this stuff obsessively. They'll do what's called a home assessment, sometimes literally walking through the person's home and analyzing every movement, every reach, every transition. Where are the friction points? Where is energy being wasted on unnecessary steps? And then they'll redesign the layout or the routine to eliminate those drains.
This is making me think about something the prompt asked. How do you adapt these principles if you can't access an OT? Because a home assessment by a professional is a luxury most people don't have.
And this is where I think the DIY approach can still get you pretty far if you're methodical about it. The first step is doing your own activity log, just for a week. Write down what you do and how you feel after. You don't need clinical training to notice patterns. Every time I do X, I feel terrible for the rest of the day. Or, I consistently have good focus between 9 and 11 in the morning.
The log is the poor man's home assessment.
It really is. And the second step is applying the 4Ps framework yourself. Get a piece of paper, list everything you need to do this week, and ruthlessly categorize. What actually matters? What can be dropped? What can be chunked? What can be moved to a different day to avoid stacking?
The problem I see with the DIY approach is accountability. An OT is an external structure. They check in, they adjust the plan, they hold you to it. When you're doing it yourself, it's very easy to let the system slide after a week.
That's a fair point. One workaround I've seen recommended is finding an accountability partner, not a therapist, just a friend or family member who agrees to check in with you once a week about how the system is going. It's a lightweight version of the therapeutic relationship.
Like body doubling, but for the metatask of managing your own energy system.
And there's another concept from OT that I think is really useful for the DIY crowd. It's called energy banking. The idea is that you identify activities that restore your energy, not just activities that are rest in the passive sense. For some people, scrolling on their phone is restful. For others, it's actually draining. A restorative activity might be listening to music or sitting outside or doing a creative hobby or talking to a specific friend.
Distinguishing between rest and restoration. That's not a distinction most people make.
It's crucial, though. Because if your rest activities aren't actually restoring anything, you're just spending time without refilling the tank. An OT will help someone build a menu of restorative activities and schedule them proactively, not as a reward for getting things done, but as a necessary part of the energy management system.
That flips the script. Most people rest when they're already exhausted, which is like waiting until your car breaks down to get an oil change.
That's exactly the analogy. And for populations with significant energy limitations, proactive rest isn't optional. It's what keeps them functional. The CDC's pacing guidance for ME/CFS explicitly recommends scheduled rest periods, even when the person feels okay in the moment. Because by the time you feel you need it, you've often already overdone it.
Let's talk about the context switching piece more directly. The prompt mentions ADHD and task interruption, and I know this is a huge area in OT.
Context switching, moving from one task to another, has a real cognitive cost. For most people, it's noticeable but manageable. For someone with ADHD, it can be catastrophic. There's a concept called attentional residue. When you switch tasks, part of your attention stays stuck on the previous task. It takes time for that residue to clear. And for someone with ADHD, that clearing process is slower and more effortful.
Every interruption is more expensive for them than for a neurotypical person.
Significantly more expensive. And OTs address this in a few ways. One is environmental, reducing sources of interruption. That could mean noise-canceling headphones, turning off notifications, setting up a dedicated workspace with a door that closes. Another is structural, using techniques like time blocking, where specific types of work are assigned to specific blocks of time and nothing else is allowed to intrude.
Life intrudes anyway, especially with kids.
And that's where the OT approach gets more nuanced. It's not about creating a perfect interruption-free environment, that's impossible. It's about building what's called interruption recovery protocols. Essentially, a pre-planned strategy for getting back on track after you've been pulled away. That might be as simple as leaving yourself a note before you switch tasks. I was working on X, and the next step is Y, so you don't have to spend 10 minutes reconstructing your mental state when you return.
That's brilliantly simple. A sticky note is a cognitive bookmark.
There's research on this from the productivity literature as well. The simple act of writing down where you left off dramatically reduces the time it takes to re-engage with a task after an interruption.
What about the digestive condition angle? We touched on meal timing, but are there other OT strategies for people whose energy crashes are food-triggered?
One is meal composition analysis, working with the person, sometimes alongside a dietitian, to identify which foods or meal sizes trigger the worst symptoms, and then adjusting accordingly. Maybe smaller, more frequent meals work better. Maybe certain foods need to be avoided during work hours. Another is what's called task food coupling, essentially matching the type of food to the type of activity that follows. If someone knows that a heavy lunch causes 2 hours of brain fog, they might shift their largest meal to the evening when they're done with cognitively demanding work.
You're not just scheduling tasks around meals. You're also scheduling meals around tasks.
It goes both ways. And for people with conditions like IBS or Crohn's, where symptoms can be unpredictable, OTs often focus on building flexible systems that can accommodate sudden bad days. That might mean having a tiered to-do list, a good day list, a medium day list, and a bad day list. On a bad day, you're only expected to do the absolute essentials, and that's considered a success.
The tiered list is such a humane idea. It bakes self-compassion into the system itself.
That's really what good OT does. It acknowledges the reality of the person's condition without judgment, and builds a structure that works within that reality rather than against it. I read a case study. This was in a journal article from the American Occupational Therapy Association about a woman with severe ME/CFS who was a mother of 2 young children. She couldn't get out of bed most days. The OT worked with her to identify the one activity that mattered most to her, reading to her kids at bedtime, and then built the entire daily energy budget around protecting enough capacity for that single activity.
Everything else was secondary.
Everything else was secondary. They restructured the household so her partner handled mornings. They set up a rest schedule that peaked in the late afternoon so she'd have a window of energy in the evening. And they created a setup where she could read to the kids from a reclining position with minimal physical strain. It wasn't the life she had before, but it preserved the thing that mattered most.
That's heartbreaking and beautiful at the same time. And it gets at something I think is under-discussed. the grief piece. Losing the ability to do things the way you used to is a real loss, and a lot of the resistance to OT-style accommodations comes from not wanting to admit that loss.
There's a concept in OT called occupational identity, the sense of who you are based on the activities that define your life. When illness or disability takes away those activities, it's not just a practical problem, it's an identity crisis. A good OT addresses both layers. They help the person find new ways to engage in meaningful activities, or sometimes help them redefine what meaningful activity looks like.
Which is way beyond, here's a grab bar for you shower.
And that's why I get frustrated when OT gets reduced to home modifications and adaptive equipment. Those are tools in the toolkit, but the actual work is much deeper. It's about helping someone reconstruct a life that works with the body and brain they actually have.
Let's pivot to the practical takeaway. Someone's listening to this. They struggle with energy unpredictability. They can't afford or access an OT. What's the minimum viable system they can set up this week?
I'd say there are 5 things. First, do the activity log for 1 week. Pen and paper, no special tools needed. Just track what you do and how you feel. Second, identify your energy patterns. When are your good hours? What triggers your crashes? What activities are disproportionately draining? Third, apply the 4 P's to your week. Prioritize ruthlessly. Plan your high-energy tasks for your peak hours. Pace yourself with scheduled breaks and look at your physical positioning. Fourth, build a menu of restorative activities and schedule at least one of them every day proactively. And fifth, create a tiered task list, good day, medium day, bad day, so you always know what success looks like regardless of how you wake up feeling.
That's concrete. I'd add a 6th, which is the interruption recovery note. Leave yourself a crumb trail when you switch tasks. It costs almost nothing and saves a surprising amount of mental energy.
And I think there's a point here that's worth making explicit. All of these strategies share a common thread. They externalize structure. Instead of relying on your internal sense of energy and prioritization, which for the populations we're talking about is unreliable, you build systems outside yourself that do the work for you. The activity log externalizes your memory of how things felt. The tiered list externalizes the decision about what matters. The scheduled breaks externalize the pacing.
It's like building a prosthetic executive function.
That's exactly what it is. And that's why OT is so effective for these populations. It's not trying to fix the underlying condition, it's building scaffolding around it so the person can function despite it.
Which is also why it's so transferable. You don't need a medical degree to build scaffolding. You just need the willingness to look honestly at your own patterns and the discipline to stick to the systems you create.
The discipline piece is the hard part, and I want to be careful not to oversell the DIY approach. For someone with severe ME/CFS or complex ADHD, professional OT support makes an enormous difference. But for the broad middle of people who struggle with energy management but don't have a diagnosed condition or have a mild to moderate version of one of these things, these principles are useful.
Something occurred to me while you were talking about the tiered list. There's a cultural resistance to this whole approach, especially in productivity-obsessed circles. The idea of having a bad day list feels like giving up, like you're admitting defeat in advance.
That's the hustle culture trap. And it's particularly damaging for the populations we're discussing because it pushes them to consistently operate beyond their energy envelope, which leads to more crashes, which leads to lower overall productivity and worse health outcomes.
The tortoise and the hare. But the tortoise has a clinically validated pacing strategy.
I resent how well that works as a metaphor given our respective species.
I said nothing about donkeys.
You didn't have to.
Let's talk about something the prompt raises that we haven't addressed directly. Childcare. Energy management when you're responsible for small humans is a completely different game.
Children are basically unpredictable energy demands with legs. An OT working with a parent who has energy limitations will often focus on what's called co-occupation, activities that the parent and child can do together that meet both of their needs simultaneously. For a parent with fatigue, that might mean setting up a cozy reading corner where they can lie down while the child looks at books next to them. It's not the same as running around the playground, but it preserves the connection.
Connection is the thing that actually matters.
Another strategy is what OTs call energy-efficient parenting. This involves things like preparing snacks and activities in advance during a good energy window, so that during a low energy window, the child can be self-directed with minimal parental input. Or creating guest spaces in the home, areas that are fully child-proofed so the parent doesn't have to constantly monitor and intervene.
That's a term I haven't heard before.
It comes from Montessori education, but OTs have adopted it. The idea is that if a space is designed so the child can explore freely without getting hurt or breaking things, the parent's cognitive load drops dramatically. They're not constantly scanning for danger or saying no.
You're modifying the environment to reduce the energy cost of supervision.
And for parents with ADHD, there's another layer. Managing the child's routine can actually help manage the parent's ADHD symptoms. External structure benefits both parties. If the parent builds a consistent morning routine for the kid, they're also building a consistent morning routine for themselves.
I like that.
The other thing OTs emphasize for parents with energy limitations is what's called delegation and resource mapping. Basically, identifying which tasks can be offloaded to other people. A partner, a family member, a neighbor, a paid service if affordable, and which tasks require the parent's personal involvement. And then letting go of guilt about the delegation.
The guilt is the hardest part.
It really is. And OTs spend a lot of time working on the cognitive reframing around delegation. It's not failure, it's energy triage. You're making sure your limited resources go to the things that matter most.
We've covered a lot of ground. Let me try to pull some threads together. What I'm hearing is that occupational therapy for energy management is fundamentally about three things. 1. Radical honesty about your actual capacity, achieved through systematic self-observation. 2. Environmental and structural redesign to reduce unnecessary energy expenditure. And 3. A values-driven prioritization that protects the activities that give your life meaning, even if everything else has to be stripped back.
That's a really good synthesis. And I'd add a 4th, all of this is iterative. An OT doesn't design a system once and walk away. They check in, they adjust, they respond to changes in the person's condition or life circumstances. The system evolves.
Which for the DIY person means, don't expect to get it right the first time. Treat it as an experiment. If the activity log reveals something surprising, adjust. If a scheduling strategy isn't working, try a different one.
And be wary of the perfectionism trap. The idea that if the system isn't working perfectly, you failed. Energy management is inherently messy. Some weeks will be better than others. The goal isn't a flawless system. It's a system that's resilient enough to handle the bad weeks.
Resilient enough to handle the bad weeks. That's a good place to land.
There's one more concept I want to mention because I think it's particularly useful for the post-COVID population, the prompt references. It's called post-exertional symptom exacerbation. It's similar to PEM and ME-CFS, but it seems to show up in a significant subset of long COVID patients. And the OT approach to this is extremely gradual. They use something called heart rate monitoring for pacing. The patient wears a simple heart rate monitor and learns to stay below a certain threshold during activity to avoid triggering a crash.
There's a biofeedback component.
And it's been quite effective for some patients because it gives them an objective signal. Instead of guessing whether they're overdoing it, they have a number. It externalizes the interoceptive awareness we talked about earlier.
A number you can look at is easier to trust than a feeling you might be imagining.
Especially when you've been told by doctors for months or years that your symptoms are psychosomatic or that you just need to exercise more. Having objective data is validating and practically useful.
The long COVID population has had to fight so hard just to be believed. I imagine an OT who takes their energy limitations seriously is itself therapeutic.
The therapeutic relationship matters enormously here. Being told, I believe you, and let's figure out how to work with this, is powerful medicine on its own.
I think we've given people a lot to work with. Activity logs, 4Ps, tiered task lists, energy banking, interruption recovery, environmental modification, heart rate basing. It's a toolkit.
It's a toolkit. And the beauty of it is that you don't need to implement all of it at once. Pick one thing. Maybe start with the activity log. See what you learn. Add from there. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The word fulgurite comes from the Latin fulgur, meaning lightning. These glass tubes form when lightning strikes sand or rock, instantly melting it at temperatures exceeding 1800 degrees Celsius. The longest fulgurite ever found was excavated in northern Florida in 1996 and measured over 16 feet. But the name itself wasn't standardized until the 1980s, when a geologist cataloging specimens in Nunavut pushed for formal adoption of fulgurite over the competing term, lightning stone.
Competing term, lightning stone. Of course, there are competing terms.
I did not know fulgurites had nomenclature drama. We've covered a lot today. Energy envelopes, pacing, the four Ps, activity logging, environmental redesign. If one thing sticks, I hope it's this. Energy management isn't about trying harder. It's about designing smarter. And the principles OTs use are available to anyone willing to look honestly at their own patterns and build systems that work with their actual body and brain.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this show happen. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.